It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. When I was growing up, our house had a back porch that was screened in and close to a big overhanging tree. And in the summer when it rained, I would sit there and knit and listen to the rain draining from the sky. It fell softly at first and then created a very nostalgic patter on the awnings. Sometimes the shower turned into a storm with loud claps of thunder and even lightning. All of this I loved so much. Recently, I was on the phone with someone in the Appalachians, and I could hear rain in the background. And while the person was speaking, lamenting about it raining, it's raining again, I was remembering how wonderful these places are, unlike here, where it rains and storms, and you can stay home and read while all of this is happening. So both of us, dissatisfied with our circumstance, wished to turn it into something else. Even now, as I am expecting the precept for today, no intoxicants, to be difficult and unpopular, I see my mind trying to do the very thing at the core of the problem, turn it into something not so uncomfortable, easier to swallow. Because the essential issue is that we're dissatisfied with our current experience and rather than searching after the truth of the life of our life, which is the starting point of Buddhism. We try to change our state using various methods, some more harmful than others. In the beginning, it seems innocent, but it's not innocent. Innocence is not to touch things at all. Innocence is not even to think of anything other than precisely what is happening right now. Today's talk will be shorter than usual because I'll be focusing on the precept's ultimate meaning. While at the conventional level, the precept of no intoxicants is understood as encouraging us to control our behavior by not using addictive substances to manipulate our state of being. Ironically, using individual effort to try to control our behavior is itself a violation of the ultimate meaning of the precept. Here is the place, here the way unfolds, as Dogen puts it. Here is the place, here the way unfolds, right here, right now. That's where it's at. Reb Anderson Roshi puts it very nicely. I'm going to read a paragraph. Most people cannot stand to just be ordinary. So we have Zen centers to train people to be patient and accept their ordinariness. Manjushri, Bodhisattva, went all the way to become a completely ordinary person. Thus, he realized that there is really no such thing as an ordinary person living all by herself. This is called waking up. When someone is having trouble staying awake, I can give her some advice. But actually, the ultimate practice is, if you are having trouble staying awake, have trouble staying awake. It's okay to try to stay awake when you are having trouble staying awake. It's okay to try to stay awake when you have trouble staying awake. It's all right to be a person trying to stay awake. But before you do anything, first of all, be this person and feel what it is like to be a person who is stuck in this state. Being this person is your ticket, your price of admission into the eon of emptiness. Being this person is the way to practice just sitting. That's the paragraph I wanted to read to you, but it's so, it's very moving to me because I do feel that we all struggle with just being ordinary, just our ordinary selves. And it seems so boring and uninteresting. And, you know, we haven't accomplished anything and the whole thing. But we have to stay there. We just have to stay there. That's everything. That's the lesson. Stay. Just stay there. So in a state of craving to be out of who we are at the moment, we may want to bring something in, anything really, if it will give us pleasure or take the pain away. Thus, we disrespect the current manifestation of our precious human life. This term, precious human life, it's a Tibetan Buddhist phrase used to emphasize how rare and how hard it is to attain a human incarnation. The only form of existence that is able to attain enlightenment. That's what's so special about being human. It's hard to become a human being. And the main thing about being a human being, the special thing about it, is our ability to attain enlightenment. Therefore, actually, that becomes the whole purpose of our life. And most of us don't even know what it, don't even think about it ever. So anyway, whenever you use a substance or a state of being, based on craving, whenever the use of a substance or a state of being is based on craving, it becomes an intoxicant. I'm going to say that once again. Whenever the use of a substance or a state of being is based on craving, it becomes an intoxicant. So my sitting there, wishing it would rain, and then I could be in that place where I was as a kid, that's an intoxicant. Let me give you some examples of intoxicants that we don't normally think of as intoxicants, like scratching and itch aggressively so that there's blood, just because it itches so much, can be an intoxicant. Yelling or screaming at someone can be an intoxicant. It's just so relieving. Biting your nails or picking at your skin or cutting can all be intoxicants. Buying things and hoarding can be intoxicants. Video games, violent films, Netflix can be intoxicants. Killing, as in hunting, or even just killing, or stealing. Indeed, breaking any of the precepts habitually can be an intoxicant. Ironically, regarding the last, Kosho Uchiyama Roshi, in a commentary on Dogen's Bendoa, said, when we observe a certain precept, we are released from the delusory desire corresponding to that precept. You are emancipated as much as you practice. So that's good to know. I'm going to read that again because it is so good to know. When we observe a certain precept, we are released from the delusory desire corresponding to that precept. So we observe a certain precept, we're released from the delusion of that precept. You are emancipated as much as you practice. I think that's really good to know. So ignorance means to not understand the nature of the self. To not understand the nature of the self. Ignorance means no light. Drugs and alcohol numb or hyperexcite the mind and extinguish the inherent light that is there. But how does the impulse to abuse or simply change our state arise anyway? How does this happen? And the impulse to modify and manipulate comes from turning away from what Dogen calls the great brightness of our being. In this great brightness, nothing can be brought in. Being upright with this great brightness, we have no desire to bring something in. Because the independent self is afraid of this great brightness, where there are no tethers, it wants to fix it and bring something in to hold on to. That's the independent self, notice, not the non-individual independent self that is interconnected with all beings. So the independent self is afraid of this great brightness where there are no tethers, and it wants to fix it and bring something in to hold on to. But such efforts are futile. Control is not possible. Control is not possible. But if you don't believe that, you have to test it out for yourself. Using trial and error, just try it out to see if maybe you can control something. And just test it out and see. Facing the great full brightness of our being where nothing is brought in and nothing needs to be brought in is called being upright. That's what it's called. You face the great fullness of our being where nothing is brought in and nothing needs to be brought in. That's what being upright is. And it's Zazen, actually. Sitting upright in this brightness, we study the precept, no intoxicants, say, any of the precepts, the precepts will tell us its secret in the very way that we will be able to understand. It's magical. Even in moments of great pain and anxiety, our work is to be present with it. We listen to it closely and hear what it is telling us. We're all doing this to some extent, but we must be thoroughgoing, bring to it everything we can, really thoroughgoing. Being upright is not for the sake of improving yourself or your situation. We are upright just to be upright for the sake of all beings. We're just upright, that's all. Actually, it's forgetting self-concern. As Anderson Roshi puts it, being upright and self-forgetting allows the Dharma flower to open in whatever circumstances come to be. The Dharma flower is already opening everywhere throughout the universe. The opening of the Dharma flower can be realized in any experience, in any time, and in any place if we uprightly receive and practice this magnificent precept of not intoxicating mind or body of self or others. This is a subtle point, and it may be, it's a very sophisticated practice, and if you feel you can't practice it now, at least you'll know about it and grow into being able to practice it. This idea of not controlling even ourselves. So doing something to try to improve yourself is not this bodhisattva. This is not the precept. This precept is about liberating self and others from self-concern. It is precisely about not using anything to improve anybody and using everything to help everybody. It is precisely about not using anything to improve anybody and using everything to help everybody. This precept is about dropping self-concern and appreciating beings just as they are. To be clear, admitting an impulse, let's say to drink, is not the same as trying to control yourself. Saying at an AA meeting, for example, "Hi, I'm Joe and I'm an alcoholic," really means, "Hi, I, Joe, realize that I'm not in control of myself and I'm not going to get in control of myself." This is a very enlightened behavior. And by such an admission, you acknowledge that it is not by personal effort that you become free. That admission is in itself the entryway to the freedom you desire. That admission in itself is the entryway to the freedom you desire. I'm not in control and I'm not going to get in control. That's the actual truth. When one accepts oneself and allows oneself just to be oneself, all one's energies turn toward the welfare of others. When one accepts oneself and allows oneself just to be oneself, all one's energies turn toward the welfare of others. Consciousness of one's precious human life and staying settled on the brightness of one's precious human life is the critical point. This is Zazen, which is called the self making the self into the self. That's what Zazen is. Zazen is the self making the self into the self. We sit, and as we sit, the self becomes the self. That's all. So that's what Rev is referring to as becoming ordinary. We're just our ordinary self. That's what we're striving to be, our ordinary self. That said, receiving and caring for the precepts involves both hearing the commitment from others and making the commitment oneself. You do not hear and make commitments by your own power, nor can anyone do it for you. So this is the magic. You can't do it yourself, and no one can do it for you. It's a mysterious process that happens in communion, and it is born that way. And I'm thinking maybe that's why the 12-step programs have been so inordinately successful. We need communion to make this happen, this mysterious process happen. And just consider it mysterious, and it's done in communion. And people who do the 12 steps are usually very successful, and they stay friends with their community for their whole lives. Everyone shows up at your funeral. I've seen it again and again. We need to acknowledge that the harm that comes to individual use of intoxicants, there is a concomitant disaster that puts the entire world at risk. As Anderson Roshi says, I think this is very beautiful. That's why I'm quoting it. I want this precept to be idiomatic, to live on the streets of this country and the world. I want it to be cool not to take drugs. I want it to be cool to realize Buddha's mind, and thus not to need to bring in anything. I want all beings to realize who they really are, and thereby see that they don't need to be any different from who they are. Here are some of the most important points from today's talk. First, innocence is to not touch things at all. Innocence is not even to think of anything other than precisely what is happening right now. Second, whenever the use of a substance or state of being is based on craving, it becomes an intoxicant. Third, this impulse to modify and manipulate and thus abuse your precious human life comes from turning away from what Dogen calls the great brightness of our being. In this great brightness, nothing can be brought in. Being upright with this great brightness, we have no desire to bring something in. That state that Dogen is talking about, you can really feel in Zazen. It's just very much there. It's very much there. And I think the longer we practice Zazen, which is considered different from all other forms of meditation because it was the way of all of the Buddhist ancestors, every single one of them, practiced this exact same thing with the exact same results. That's why it's considered the path. It's the path itself. The fourth point, doing something to try to improve yourself is not this bodhisattva precept. This precept is about liberating self and others from self-concern. It is precisely about not using anything to improve anybody and using everything to help everybody. Fifth, when one accepts oneself and allows oneself just to be oneself, all one's energies turn toward the welfare of others. And sixth, today, there's a sixth one. We need to acknowledge that beyond the harm that comes to the individual use of intoxicants, there is a concomitant disaster that puts the entire world at risk. And for your notebooks this week, please deeply consider the following. First, consider what Dogen means by his use of the term great brightness. What has gotten in the way of you seeing your life as a place of great brightness? Why aren't we all seeing that? We should all be seeing that. Second, in what ways do you turn away from your precious life? Just think about how do I do that? Third, pick out something that perhaps you deal with aggressively, you know, just hard, and experiment with dealing with it with gentleness and clarity instead. The results may not be as immediate, but your nervous system will be less alarmed. Try it. When I say aggressively, I mean like that, you know, that's, I do it. Scratching really hard when there's just an unbearable itch. And I consider that aggressive. And there are just other ways where we, cutting is definitely aggressive. I don't think any of you do that, but lots of people do. So fourth, one definition of Zazen is the self making the self into the self. The self making the self into the self. What do you think that means? And fifth, one subject today people ubiquitously turn away from is death. Uchiyama Roshi says, if we only think of existence and neglect thinking of death, our life is like a plastic flower. It doesn't die, but it has no fragrance, is not animated, and bears no fruit. Gradually, it will become filthy and be thrown away. Please comment on this potent statement. I'll read it again. And this is addressing our, you know, never thinking about death, if at all possible. It's actually considered depressing. You know, why are you so depressed? You think about death all the time. And Uchiyama Roshi says, if we only think of existence and neglect thinking of death, our life is like a plastic flower. It doesn't die, but it has no fragrance, is not animated, and bears no fruit. Gradually, it will become filthy and will be thrown away. And to please comment on this statement that says everything, I think. I wonder if there are questions.
Thank you, Gail. So there's a first question that we have. Somebody said, hello, Gail. Thank you very much for your talk today. You were right. This one is very challenging. As someone who does not drink or smoke, I had actually thought that this would be the one precept I might have a chance of being able to keep. But the way you describe it, I probably break it 99% of the time. When am I not acting in craving, checking my phone, making tea, getting something to eat, reading that book, watching a movie? It's nearly all driven by not being satisfied by the present moment. Isn't that the meaning of samsara? I know you've touched on this before. But how does anyone ever take these vows, knowing they will be entirely unable to even keep one?
Yes. I've talked about this briefly in a previous talk. I don't know if you remember, it was when I was asking you to make your own personal vow. And by the way, this would be a really good subject for you to make a personal vow around this. And also a vow of repentance. And the reason, this is the very reason why the second vow of repentance, you know, I'm going to interrupt myself because Dogen Zenji, our great teacher, said that we only need to do Zazen. Zazen includes everything. Zazen includes everything. And I know, of course, he's absolutely correct. Zazen includes repentance. But it seems to me, and given what you've just said, like practically every single action needs repenting, that we need to have a vow of repentance. We just need to have a way of making sure that that this extra sure that that happens. So what I am called to say to you is exactly what Reb was saying. You know, we need to simply stay. We need to stay present in the fact that we're never able to stop controlling ourselves. We're never able to just be satisfied with who we are right now. But there's always something we want to change or get or, you know, stimulate ourselves, have coffee, whatever it is, be warm. There's always something. And to stay with that awareness, because think of it this way, what if you weren't aware of that? Then there's no hope, right? And almost no one is aware of it. I mean, when you think of the population of the world, what we're talking about is pretty esoteric. And so number one, not to feel so bad if you haven't even gotten to step one, which most of us. But at least we know, and we can stay present, and we actually know, oh, I'm feeling that I want a cold drink right now. It doesn't seem so bad, but this idea of if it's, you know, it doesn't mean that we can't have anything, but if it becomes a craving, like we have to have this to fix ourselves, then it's an intoxicant. So there is a distinction. There's a distinction of just, I think when my personal explanation of the difference is like at Tassajara, there's a schedule and we have three meals a day. We have breakfast and da-da-da, and then we have lunch and da-da-da, and then we have dinner. And so all things come in their correct order, and they do come, and you don't starve, and there is time to sleep, even if it's not enough. That's different from craving. I think that's all.
Thank you, Gail. The second comment that we got is, after the many weeks of these sessions, today's message does not surprise or discourage me. Yet I feel that anything less than total abstinence is not acceptable. No coffee for sure, no salt even. I know I cannot practice enough to achieve that, but that should not stop me from practicing more. It hurts being ordinary. I'm sure others feel this way. Mm-hmm.
You know, don't forget that Zen practice as Suzuki Roshi says, is it not always so? There's nothing that's always so. So please remember that, because it's very important. Regarding coffee, since you mentioned it, I once heard a Tibetan Buddhist Rinpoche, who's like a Zen Roshi, that's a similar category, say, there's nothing wrong with coffee. You know, it helps you do what you're doing better. He said that. So I'm just saying, maybe, you know, if coffee is not a craving, then there's nothing wrong with it. So it's this craving aspect. We crave to change who we are in the moment. And it sounds like you're working with that. And that's all, you know, it's not about being perfect. It's actually about the process of being of awareness and creating greater awareness. That's what it's about. There's no description of, well, at the end, we'll have this checklist and you'll do all those things and then you'll be perfect. It's not like that. It's really not like that. Thank goodness. And that's all.
Thank you. The next question we have is, what do you think of doing Zazen while you're stoned? Some people say it makes it even better.
I'm gonna tell you what John Daido Luri Roshi once said about this subject. He said that trying to do Zazen while you're stoned or drunk is like trying to swim the English Channel with an anchor tied around your neck. It cannot be done. The drugs do precisely the opposite of what samadhi does. Samadhi is a single-pointed awareness and falling away of body and mind, which you can experience in Zazen. Pot activates and scatters the mind. He says there's no connection whatsoever between drugs and genuine spiritual practice. That's all. I don't want to comment on that, really. That's all.
Thank you. So someone shared that lately I am finding what I think of as my normal state of anxiety as going off the walls. I feel compelled to complete every single work assignment to a level of perfection beyond what is asked for, and to do so, I'm missing sleep, exercise, and Zazen. I want to change this, but so far my efforts have not been futile. I have thought to consult a psychiatrist, but I don't trust them and it scares me. That's how it is for me day after day.
I think this is an example of something being physically off in your body, and consulting a psychiatrist would be appropriate, because if something is like mechanically the matter, at least I think, and other people might disagree, that you can address it mechanically. So if there's anxiety off the wall and you've already tried to work with it to the best of your ability by staying present with it, it seems like there may be merit in using medicine to help you. This is one of those, again, this is one of those instances of anything that happens to us in our life. There's no one rule that is always the rule. It's not always one thing doesn't apply to all circumstances. And remember that story of the Buddha himself in a past lifetime, killing someone whose thought he could, because he was the Buddha in a past lifetime, he had the power to read other people's thoughts because they really weren't other people. And he saw that one pirate on the boat was thinking of killing everybody else on the boat so that he could have the treasure that the boat was carrying. And the Buddha killed him and then was praised for his actions. That's a very good example of how nothing always applies to every situation. Everything in Buddhism is not always so. So you really, we're forced to, do you see how this pushes us to stay present with what's happening right now from in this body and mind? What is happening right now in this body and mind? And then we make the appropriate response. And that was another thing that was talked about in a very early lecture. Someone asked the Shakyamuni Buddha, I think, if you had to say what Buddhism is all about in a nutshell, what would you say? And he said, an appropriate response. And that's because to make an appropriate response, we need all of the teachings. We need to have integrated all of the teachings so that we make the appropriate response. And that's what this problem for you, this extreme and intense anxiety, your practice is to make the appropriate response. And it isn't written somewhere in a book. That's all. It's not written somewhere in a book. That's all I can say to help you.
Thank you, Gail. That was the last question we had.
All right. I will look forward to seeing people next week. And perhaps the subject will be easier to swallow. Bye-bye.